My name is Ray Choate. I'm the University Librarian here at the University of Adelaide, and it gives me great pleasure indeed to welcome you to this Friends function this evening, where we have a very interesting speaker. Unfortunately, even though he writes about cricket, I have learnt to my dismay as a Hawthorne supporter that he ain't a Hawthorne supporter. I won't give away who he barracks for, just in case there's a lot of enemies in the crowd tonight. But we do welcome you here this evening. If you have one of these contraptions, if I can dig mine out, and I'm sure it's not on. If you have one of these, please put it on silent mode. It just makes things a lot easier during the lectures if they don't go off. Now, while you're doing that, I will ask the president of the Friends of the Library, Oliver Mayo, who needs no introduction, if he will do the honors of introducing our speaker. Oliver.
Thank you, Ray, for letting us use your excellent library once more. Welcome everybody, myself. It's a great pleasure to introduce Gideon Haig, Gideon Clifford Jeffrey Davidson Haig. Born to a Yorkshire father and an Australian mother, and if I said where he was brought up, you'd know who he barracks for, so I won't. But his father clearly expected him to play rugby for England. Now, most people think he's another cricket writer, albeit more thoughtful and better than most. But he's a writer first and a cricket writer second, in my view, even though around two-thirds of his more than 30 books are indeed to do with cricket. Books that I think are particularly worth mentioning, not that the others aren't, but I haven't read them all, The Big Ship, his marvellous biography of Warwick Armstrong, and explaining how cricket took one of its modern forms, The Strange Cult of the CEO, or Fat Cats, and The Racket, how abortion became legal in Australia. They're all notable for the clarity and the accuracy with which he writes and the way he makes tough subjects enjoyable even while you're not actually relishing the subject matter. And I sometimes think that for example, the loss of the Ashes last time, I sometimes think that his next book will probably be a novel about a megalomaniac CEO and his totally crooked and cynical offsiders taking over Australian cricket and bringing to an end civilization as we know it. But then he's actually written that as a factual book early on. And anyway, you don't want to hear me, you want to hear Gideon, so please come and speak.
Thank you for the introduction and the invitation to speak tonight. I'm not much of a speaker, but I am cheap. I am used, I must say, to addressing sporting audiences, and I usually begin with an anecdote that David Lloyd tells about the first time he spoke at a sportsman's night, and a pissed club president came up and said, "I think you're the worst speaker I've ever seen." The vice president diplomatically intervened, "Don't worry, David, he just repeats what everyone else is saying." I know you'd not be nearly so impolite, and you'll say it under your breath. After all, this is Adelaide. I was last here for the test match, and a very excellent test match it was too, especially restored to its traditional time slot, and Australia very deserved winners. I enjoyed watching Australia last summer, as much as in years. They're a battling team now, but they battle with the spirit of a unit. They're probably bound to disappoint us from time to time, but I don't think they'll capitulate as they did in the Ashes series that Oliver mentioned before. I had the, for me, unique experience last summer of watching a friend make his test debut, Ed Cowan, the Australian opening batsman, a good player and a champion fellow. He speaks glowingly of the present setup in the Australian team, the selectors, the coach, the older heads like Ponting and Hussey. We had dinner in Adelaide with John Inverarity too, who's a very substantial individual. Character is receiving its due in Australian cricket these days, and it's good to see. I noticed that this evening has been promoted under the title It's Not Cricket, with the promise that the title is as witty as the speaker. God, I hope I can do better than that, because it makes me sound like Henry Blofeld, you know. But it actually, it kind of works because it has preserved for me the maximum freedom. After all, with a title like that, I could talk about cricket, as in, it's not cricket, or something else, as in, it's not cricket, whatever my orientation. It's funny, but I do get into this situation quite a lot. I think of myself as a journalist who sometimes writes about cricket. Seems simple enough. I'm bound to say, though, that it's not an altogether comfortable position in Australia. For one thing, journalist has a host of kind of unsavoury or unseemly associations. It's not one of the respectable vocations like reality TV star or celebrity chef. People assume that when you write books that you'd rather be called a writer because somehow it spirits you into the rarefied heights of literature, while journalist sort of flushes you down the sewers of sensationalism. I've never seen it that way. Such skills as I have, talking, listening, recording, collating, writing, they are the skills of a journalist. I applied for a job as a journalist at the age of 17, not because I had a passionate sense of freedom of the press, but out of a simple desire to leave home and make a living. I probably applied in the same spirit as Tom Stoppard is meant to have applied for a job at the Daily Mirror when he left university. Apparently he turned up to the interview and a fellow said to him, "So you want to be a journalist? Are you interested in politics?" And Stoppard said, Yes, I'm interested in politics. Fellow said, "So, who's the foreign secretary?" Stoppard paused for a moment. He said, "I said I was interested, not obsessed." Anyway, being unencumbered by a tertiary education, I have no qualifications to do anything else, just like a journalist. Being unpossessed of any particular specialisation, I flit from subject to subject, just like a journalist. I do know right from wrong, but I think that very few members of the Australian media don't. There are, I grant you, unethical, dishonest, corrupt journalists. There are also unethical doctors, dishonest lawyers and corrupt policemen. I don't think the levels of malpractice in journalism in Australia are any higher than in any other walk of life, and they're possibly lower. When the Finkelstein report recently tried to come up with examples of media's misbehaviour, I thought they were amazingly lame. A classic example of what the media is sometimes accused of, fitting the facts to a predetermined headline. Journalists in Australia are inadequate in many, many respects. Intelligence, imagination, taste, tact, flair, wit, but in an ethical sense, they come up rather well. As Humbert Wolfe's famous rhyme? I'll adapt it for Australian conditions. You cannot hurt to bribe or twist, thank God the Australian journalist, but when you think what he will do unbribed, there's no occasion to. Writing about cricket, a great and abiding love of mine, has also been a mixed blessing for me. C.P. Snow famously delineated the two cultures, the humanities and the sciences. In Australia, we have something like the two cultures too. There is sport and then there is everything else. Sport is imagined to trade at a perennial advantage, to occupy an unseemly proportion of the Australian mind, to be the source of excessive celebration and unappealing hero worship, to fall in with socially conservative and drearily materialistic lifestyles, and therefore to act as a hindrance to national seriousness and to a proper appreciation of artistic and intellectual accomplishment. Sport has addled the Australian consciousness, complained Patrick White. The passion for perpetual motion, is it perhaps for fear that we may have to sit down and face reality if we don't keep going? Enthusiasm for sport is pathologised in Australia, even on its own terms, is a kind of obsession. One is a mad football fan, one is a fanatical punter, one is a golf nut, and one is, of course, a cricket tragic. Of the arts, literature and music, by contrast, one is always far more prudently and tastefully an aficionado, a connoisseur, or a devotee. To write about sport, therefore, is to be a kind of class traitor. It is providing succour to the enemy when you should be expressing solidarity with permanently embattled intellectual elites. A hardy staple of op-ed pages everywhere is the why, oh why column, complaining that Australia 10 spends too much time exalting dumb athletes and not enough promoting its cutting-edge creators, as though it's a zero-sum game and a country can only do one at a time, and as though athletes are non-creative and unartistic and artists not competitive and ambitious. Yet it's always seemed to me that simply to hold your nose and walk by on the other side of the road as sport passes by is kind of willful. We're a big country, thinly populated. Sport brings us together in great numbers and for common ends. We are a wealthy country, sometimes less equal than it fancies. Sport has an abiding demotic appeal, bringing blue bloods and battlers together in ostensible parity. We are a country remote from the rest of the world. Global sporting success provides us with heady drafts of reinforcement, a sense that other nations are paying attention to us, at least for a moment. We are a country short on civic education. Local sport is an underappreciated contributor to inculcating practices of citizenship, bonds with community, and respect for rules. When I write about sport, therefore, I don't feel like I'm slumming it. I feel, among other things, as though I'm continuing a long-term inquiry into what it is to be Australian, and indeed how that compares to being English, Asian, African, etc. I may be a little less serious and reverent than at other times, but merely because sport is apt to too great an earnestness about itself in Australia, albeit that it's probably better at taking the piss than art, music, and literature. So, yes, I am quite difficult to categorise, and I'm not quite sure that in the present environment this is a very good thing in Australia. I've just written my 25th book. It's called The Office, A Hard-Working History. It comes out next month. Here it is. It's... Yes, you can see how heavy it is. 1.53 kilograms. I was sending one in the post the other day and that's what it came out at. Yeah. It traces the emergence and evolution of offices, office work, and office life from antiquity to a present day in which these can be anywhere, in your phone or in your home. I thought I'd tell you something about the writing life behind it and therefore give you a sense of what it's like to write non-fiction in Australia. It's very large, as you can see, and it took some intellectual heavy lifting as well. I can't remember a blinding flash when I had the idea of writing a book like this. It seemed rather an idea that I'd always had. It was a book that I wanted to read, that simply seemed unlikely to be written unless I did it myself. Quite simply, we are a world of office workers, and we have become that way in the space of roughly a century. How did a society that once grew things and made things come to find meaning in lives with outcomes so apparently immaterial? It's fascinating. It's often seemed to me too that we are most human when at work, precisely when we're doing our best to hide it by being reliable, rational, and efficient. I finally grew serious about the office about 4 years ago when I was working on a book that Oliver mentioned called The Racket, which examined in quite granular detail the corrupt and claustrophobic world of illegal abortion in Melbourne in the 1960s. And after delving into a subject so intense and intimate and local and of its time, I was excited by the prospect of a next book that was so obviously panoramic, everyday, global and evolving. Much of the journalism I've done has involved teasing out quite small stories to kind of reveal their largeness. It's always engaging and exciting, but it has always committed me essentially to the exploration of a broadly definable country of knowledge. The Office, by contrast, was a country with indistinct and porous borders, as well as a mysterious interior. These are exquisite moments in a writer's life. It's like the budding of a romance when everything seems possible and nothing seems to be off limits. But of course, romance obscures practicalities. I had little idea of how I'd tackle the subject, what the book would look like, its tone, its length, its depth, its presentation, its market, all of which are things in which publishers are rather vitally and necessarily interested. Having eschewed an agent, I was the salesman for the office long before I was its researcher and writer. And I went off about 3.5 years ago looking for an advance to sustain me the 3 years that I estimated the task would take. Now, what would you expect to be paid for 3 years of your time? There is a disjunction in Australian letters. The most enthusiastic and imaginative publishers are invariably the ones with no money. The bigger the publisher, usually the more cautious. One independent publisher whom I really liked and who immediately twigged as to the book's possibilities offered $5,000. Next 3 years, $5,000. From the bigger end of town, I can roughly summarise the response as being, well, Gideon, we like your work, but you know, what we really like is the big book by Gideon Haig. This expression I heard again and again, the big book. In nonfiction, a big book is one either written by Peter Fitzsimons or concerning an already overexposed athlete, media proprietor, or warrior. The office was huge, but it wasn't big. It featured no well-known celebrity or public figure, and it was nobody's idea of fun. I spend most of my time trying to get out of the office, said one publisher. God, that's funny, I said. I couldn't point to a personal track record of commercial success. Quite the contrary. I couldn't point to a similar book that had succeeded, and publishers love a similar book that succeeded. Worst of all, perhaps, I was proposing a book that wasn't particularly Australian. The kind of book that multinational publishers... I was proposing the kind of book that multinational publishers rely on from their parent companies. Australian non-fiction authors are meant to interpret Australia, or at least guarantee a decidedly Australian angle. The office was always going to be a long-distance romance. I hadn't actually realised these taboos until I tried to breach them. I wanted to be ambitious. I wanted to do something unusual and innovative. I wanted to stretch as a journalist and a thinker, even if I couldn't somehow pull it off. And that placed me, I discovered, completely at odds with the culture of publishing in this country, which almost seems to want to produce books that have already been published. Anyway, to boil it down, a field of about 15 publishers with whom I shared the idea steadily shrank to two, who could make a business case in the hope of a foreign rights sale, in other words, selling it abroad, Coles to Newcastle style. I settled on Melbourne University Publishing, whose commissioning editor, Fung Ling Kong, I knew, liked and respected, and it proved a good choice. MUP actually offered by far the largest advance I had ever accepted, and arguably far more than I deserved, based on my prior sales, the state of the economy, the uncertainties besetting the publishing industry. It was also when spaced over 3 years, less than two-thirds of the minimum wage. And after the expenditure of approximately a third on various research activities, it would work out to an hourly rate of, well, actually, if you did those sums, you would find a vocation more lucrative, like digging ditches or holding stop signs near roadworks. That's okay, by the way. They are the rules, and they have been for the 25 years since I first became a published author. And I'm luckier than most in being able to turn my hand to newspaper and magazine journalism to subsidise my writing of books. But I do so of necessity. It's the equivalent, in my mind, of taking in washing or waiting tables, done for continuity of cash flow. let's just say I did have a few needs. Into the year after signing my contract, I squeezed three experiences that sit high in the rankings of those regarded as life-altering. I married Charlotte, I became a parent to Cecilia, and I abandoned the closest thing that I had to a job, which was my role as a regular contributor to the Monthly because of its scurvy treatment of its editor, Sally Warhaft. So I had, in short, halved my income and multiplied my responsibilities. I still can't quite believe that I did that. I partly remedied the former by accepting offers to cover the 2009 Ashes series in England from the Business Spectator and the Times. Charlotte and I had always intended to make this a kind of a form of honeymoon. We'd then visit Europe and the US on the way home as a kind of a field trip, taking in places of historic office interest. You can see I'm just an old romantic at heart. I take my wife to the Ashes, then I take a look at offices. We ended up doing it during Charlotte's second trimester, which, let's just say, made it even more of a bonding experience. Otherwise, we economised. We took no more holidays, we bought no gifts, we drove a bomb, we made do and mended. The only breaks that I took in the writing of this book were to report the test matches of 2010-11 and 2011-12. Charlotte had no breaks at all. She had married a man already in a torrid relationship with his book. Funny things happen to you when you write books, or at least, I don't know, they happened to me. Once Charlotte gave birth to Cecilia, I realised that I had no small talk whatsoever. I had lost interest in anything beyond my work and my home, and even they were in tension. There was a little guilt in attending to each because the other was always lurking. In order to shoehorn 13 or 14 hours work into the day, I started early, usually at 5 a.m., and I finished late. I put in time after 10 p.m. I strove to keep early evenings free, so to play with Thomas the Tank Engine and watch Peppa Pig, and my study door I always kept open as a tiny gesture of integration with the rest of the household. Actually, the change table was just outside my study door, so every time a nappy was changed, I had to go out to play the role of, and this is probably getting into a too much detail, but to play the role of poo puppet, because my daughter didn't like having her nappy changed and she would only do it if I played with this puppet while we were doing it. Anyway, look, I can't say I was any great use as a new father, and sometimes I was none at all. I could perform mechanical duties, a few of them handy. I could, for instance, relieve Charlotte by walking the streets with Cecilia in the baby Bjorn as she cried her little lungs out. But, and it's a lamentable admission, I was probably thinking about offices at the time. An author with a book on his mind is a bad, bad person. There's a story about the English writer Simon Raven taking himself off to write a book and receiving a telegram from his wife that read, "Wife and baby starving." And he sent a telegram back saying, "Eat baby." Didn't get quite that bad with me, but it's actually possible that my sensations of isolation while writing this book were more desolating because there was a wife and a daughter nearby. I'd always imagined myself temperamentally quite fit for a sort of a monastic existence. Now it didn't seem such a natural fit. Anyway, whatever the case, a long-term non-fiction project is a little bit like rowing a little boat towards the horizon without quite knowing what lies beyond. Soon enough, you're in dark blue water, and there's no sign of land in any direction, and you've got no choice but to keep rowing. And you concentrate on each stroke to keep from wondering when and where you're going to arrive, or even whether there's any point. Because as my book grew, so did its apparent readership contract. It's true. The book market in Australia has shrunk by about a fifth since I started. The collapse of Borders A&R seems to have taken the readers that they served with them. The only books as large as mine in Australian bookstores now are cookbooks. Frankly, you can buy The Office or you can buy Movida. Look, frankly, I'm not going to try and sell this book to you. In fact, I'm actually going to give you this book. I've bought a copy along to donate to the University of Adelaide Library tonight. Funny enough, it actually has a section on a distinguished university alumnus in Elton Mayo. So it's kind of appropriate. Is it any good? Look, I really am totally the wrong person to ask about this. Rumour got it, the novelist once said that for a dyed-in-the-wool author, nothing is so dead as a book once it is written. All I'll say is that it's an honest piece of work by someone who did their best. I'll put the spine outwards. Funny enough, my wife and I went to a movie at the end of last year. We went to see Senna, that documentary about Ayrton Senna. And my wife, God bless her, she turned to me and she said, you know, this is the first movie we've seen in 2.5 years that hasn't had something to do with officers. And it is absolutely true. Anyway, I can't look at an office now. I almost have an equal and opposite reaction to it. And since zigging with The Office, I've zagged again, and I spent March writing a short book about Shane Warne, just to go. Actually, when I say short, it's 56,000 words, and I wrote it in a month. But compared to The Office, compared to 200,000 words on offices, it is a trifle. Why did I do a book about Warner? Well, I was asked. I thought I had a few things to say that I hadn't said before. And C, he's been gone from Test cricket for 5 years. It's interesting, isn't it? It's sufficient time, I think, for us to obtain some sort of perspective on his career. He's certainly been the best of my time. Prodigiously skillful and relentlessly competitive. I've also always liked Shane. His behaviour could be exasperatingly puerile, but it was kind of free of guile and malice. It sort of possessed the incorrigibility of the mischievous kid brother. And wearing his flaws so exuberantly, he does seem to me to be quite a good advertisement for sporting success. In his brief comeback last summer, you might remember he came back to play for the Melbourne Stars in the Big Bash League. He reminded me of, you know, Norma Desmond, Gloria Swanson in Sunset Boulevard. He's still big, it's the cricket that's gotten small. And it enabled me to recall, it was very helpful actually, it enabled me to recall what it was like to watch Warne in his pomp. And it went a bit like this. I'll read you a few little bits to describe. This is a section where I just describe Warne's action, which is just to me the absolute acme of leg spin. Growing up in the 70s and 80s, you know, you always heard about leg spin, but you never actually saw it. It was almost like, you know, believing in a unicorn. But all of a sudden, there it was. And, you know, it was kind of exactly as they'd said it was. It was kind of the myth made flesh. And I'll never forget the excitement of watching Warne for the first time. And it's amazing now you can watch Warne on YouTube. You see, he's one of those sportsmen who somehow you can watch the same ball again and again and again and see something different in it each time. It's like reading a particularly beautiful or exquisite novel with many subplots and lots of subtext. I mean, the essence of kind of watching sport, part of the excitement derives from the fact that you don't know what's going to happen. You know, it's unscripted drama, but somehow Warne sort of transcends that. You can see him, you can say, oh, gotta type in the Chanderpaul ball on YouTube, and you go, how did he spin the ball that far? I'm going to watch it again. I know what's going to happen. You know that everyone on the field doesn't know what's going to happen, but you do, but it's still just as exciting for you. It's just phenomenal. Anyway, this is the way in which I describe Warne's action in this book. For Warne, the walk back was a social occasion. If it wasn't the umpire, it was the captain, a fielder, or an opponent. Anything to add a little spice to the contest, a little theatre to the event, to enhance the sense of ease, command, and imminent opportunity. All the while, Warne would be rolling the ball from his right hand into his left, half consciously, almost but not quite lost in the physical sensations of imparting and experiencing spin, the muscle and metacarpal memory. Most spinners do something similar. Murulitharan whizzes the ball inside a cupped hand, almost as though to give nothing away. Daniel Vettori gives the ball an almost neurotically tiny twist, like he's winding it up. Stuart McGill's trademark is an obsessive gimballing of the wrist, as though to ensure the joint's looseness. Warne rotated the ball from hand to hand languidly, voluptuously, like someone feeling warm sand running through their fingers. It was as amiable and intimate as a friendly handshake. As Warne rounded his disc, his demeanour began to change. He did not switch on. Warne was always on. No, he switched the rest of the game off. He brought all the activity on the field into himself. There was a pause. It was the best pause cricket has known. Preparatory, pregnant, predatory. It was this pause that Fanny Rush chose to capture for Warne's portrait in the long room at Lord's. Warne looks keenly out of the painting, down the wicket, as it were, straight back into the observer's eyes. The gaze is rock steady. The body is a study in relaxed readiness. The ball is hovering, preparatory to dropping back into his hand. It's an enigma. What's going on in there? What's next? Most bowlers at the top of their run are thinking about what they might bowl. Warne's pause was as much about letting you wonder what he might bowl. As he put it himself, part of the art of bowling spin is to make the batsman think something special is happening when it isn't. The most striking aspect of Warne's approach was its homespun nature. Fast bowlers can often be distinguished by their run-ups. Slow bowlers are not so obviously idiosyncratic. But Warne's run-up, of course, was nothing of the kind. It was a walk-up. Decisive but nonchalant, like someone sliding up to whisper sedition in your ear. The ball commenced its journey mysteriously in Warne's left hand before being imperceptibly slipped into the right, as though it was being slid around between one of three cups by a sidewalk hustler. The right hand then held the ball loosely as it could be held without actually falling out. These heterodox features of his protege's bowling at first bemused his coach, Terry Jenner. He was inclined to encourage Warne to run in faster, seemingly leading to more energy through the crease, and to grip the ball tighter, theoretically imparting more fizz. Warne's preference, as in all aspects of his life, was to do what came naturally. Running too far was uncomfortable. Holding too tightly made him tense. Jenner, sensibly, paid heed. As Warne trained and played more, he was able to rely for momentum on the drive of his back leg and the strength of his upper body. That he did not grasp the ball so much as caress it meant that he never suffered from the blisters and calluses that have plagued many a slow bowler. Where his sometime spin partner Tim May literally bled for his craft, Warne whirled away without hindrance. The action itself was essentially unimprovable. For all the seeming doughiness of his physique, Warne was hugely strong in the shoulders and backside. With only a tiny jump, little higher than it would take to clear a broomstick laid flat, he achieved colossal momentum, pushing off a back foot lying perfectly parallel with the back line, swinging his right hip powerfully round, pivoting on a front foot pointed to fine leg to deliver the maximum rotation. There was an audible grunt and a hint of tongue in the corner of the mouth as the arm came over, but little other semblance of effort. It was almost as though the propulsion came from some external elan vital. In pictures of his action, Warne might almost be a body surfer surging through a wave. And while onlookers tended to resist the idea of Warne as an athlete, because cricket involves intermittent rather than linear exertion, he achieved at peak energy the paradoxical state that is characteristic of a great athlete: immense physicality and seeming weightlessness. The action culminated in perhaps the best feature of all, the follow-through as the arm completed its arc and the body its swing, the right boot testifying to the rip and the pivot by rising above the level of the umpire's waist, the energy sweeping him 4 or 5 metres down the pitch. The eyes, meanwhile, would follow the ball all the way to the target, the lips already forming an appeal, the arms preparing to rise. Has any bowler in history taken such delight in simply beating the outside edge? Warne had a whole repertoire of gasps and groans and grins and grimaces to go with it. It was Warne at his most spontaneously joyful, revelling in the chagrin and the schadenfreude of eluding the bat in the sleight of hand and the sleight of mind. He did not need the wicket immediately. Ah, he would have that soon enough. He enjoyed for the moment showing off his art for art's sake. Look at me. Look at what I can do. A jeu d'esprit, like picking a man's pocket and giving him his wallet back. Anyway, that's part of my take on Warne. It was fun, and it was easy to write. It was easy to write because God knows I watched it 50,000 times in my career, and I can go on watching it forever. Somewhat of a change from offices, but so anyway, it allows me to say that I've covered not cricket, as in un-cricket, and not cricket, as in someone whose behaviour wasn't always cricket, although his skills were, I think, the very essence of them. I'll close by telling you a story about Warne's teammate, Merv Hughes. It's an oldie but a goodie. I love this story. It was told to me by Jeff Lawson some years ago. Merv was playing in a match for Australia against Nottinghamshire in 1989. And he was bowling a classic Merv Hughes spell, because it was verbally incontinent. Every ball was followed by, "What sort of fucking shot was that?" "The next one's going to take your fucking head off." You know, this went on for some overs until finally the umpire, at the end of the over, went to Merv, gave him his jumper, looked around the field and said, "That, gentlemen, is the end of another fucking over." And that's the end of another fucking speech.
Wasn't just another fucking speech. It was an absolutely brilliant speech by a man who says he doesn't speak well. It's the only untrue thing he's said this evening. Questions. We've got plenty of time for questions.
Yeah.
Can I ask you about your biography of Jack Iverson?
Yeah.
I think it was a really important, really good book. And I want to ask you about how you approached it. But there must have been a point when early on you didn't know much about him except on the one hand. His own spinning,
yeah,
like no one else, and he was very successful with it. But on the other hand, he never believed he had a place in his own inside, and then he died of his own hand. Seems to me writing that book had a real risk because it could have ended up in a terrible story. And
yes,
boring.
Yeah.
How did you approach that?
Well, it is, I mean, look, it's a long time ago, but I do remember it vividly. It's one of those books that really stayed with me after I wrote it. Funny thing was, I'd had it in mind to kind of write a book about Iverson because I went to Geelong College and he was an old Geelong collegian. But the interesting thing was that he hadn't really played cricket of any seriousness at college, and you went looking for his name in the school magazine and it wasn't there. And that was in contrast to Hassett and Sheehan and Redpath, who had been celebrated figures, and there was plenty of evidence of their doings at school. What started it was, fair enough, I mean, of all things, it was a little paragraph in the real estate section of The Age, which said that the Iverson house was for sale in Brighton, 44 Black Street. And I thought, that's a cue, that means something. That, I don't know, the fact that I've noticed this paragraph, I would never read the real estate section. It's probably the only occasion I've ever read it in 30 years. But the fact that I knew Iverson's address, I thought that was, well, that's a place to start. And I, as I narrate in the book, I went down to 44 Black Street. Jack, as you know, committed suicide in 1973, and this was 1998, so 25 years had elapsed since he killed himself in that house, in the back shed. And I knocked on the door and I said, you know, I understand this is where Jack Iverson, the test cricketer, you know, I said, you know, look, hello, middle-aged woman who answered in the door, whose name I don't know. You probably don't know this because it's probably been through multiple hands since then, but this house used to be occupied by an Australian test cricketer called Jack Iverson. I'm interested in cricket. I just wanted to see if I could have a look around. And she said, well, yeah, I'm Jack Ivers' daughter, Lee McNamara, and I still live in the house. And in fact, it wasn't a great discovery because she didn't want to have anything to do with anyone writing about her father. It was still a point of acute sensitivity. And so that actually, that first point of inquiry didn't get me very far. But it did interest me. It did interest me. Being able to touch the fabric or touch the concrete reality of a story is not essential. I mean, I haven't worked in an office for 15 years. I'm still very interested in them. But the ability to be able to go and visit and to kind of reintroduce yourself to your own terrain is an experience that I really love. I mentioned before I did a book about abortion in Melbourne in the 1960s, and it totally changed my view of Melbourne because I got to understand how illegal abortion was procured, and it was a world that I had never entered. It had never occurred to me that it could be so difficult. It had never occurred to me that these things had happened in my lifetime, and you know, going to read the transcripts of court cases involving abortionists and women who were prosecuted for seeking abortions in the 1960s. I thought, well, this actually happened in my lifetime. It's a Melbourne and an Australia that I don't recognise. So I always find that a really interesting and an exciting part of the task of writing, making myself see something old in a new way.
One thing, for another topic, for perhaps another book, away from Shane Warner to someone not known by me at all. Does the name Eddie Gilbert ring a bell?
Oh, yes, yeah.
So maybe, would that be possible?
Well, there was actually a very good book written about Eddie Gilbert a few years ago. Is it Mike Coleman, did it?
Ken Edwards
did the research, and Mike Coleman did the writing. Yeah. It's a very solid piece of work, I think. I recommend it highly.
Of course, 20,000 words on Gilbert too in my passport.
You did. Bernard Wimperis, distinguished historian of Indigenous cricket in Australia.
Not well, though.
I didn't say that. I didn't say.
Yeah.
Here's a subject of consuming interest because of his sheer uniqueness in Australia at the time. It's also been a very good book, or a nice little book written about Jack Marsh, who was the Indigenous fast bowler at the turn of the century, written by Max Bunnell, called How Many More Are Coming. There is a small but worthwhile literature on Indigenous cricketers in Australia, and Bernard's book, Passport to Nowhere, is probably the ur text on the subject. He didn't pay me to say that. He's smiling though. Yeah.
Hi, Gideon. Well, I actually would like to ask you about your new book, The Office. I was really interested by a comment you made about how we are in some ways more ourselves in The Office than we are other places. I'm sort of intrigued by that comment. Just wondering if you elaborate a bit on that. What you mean by that?
Well, we're kind of our ideal selves, I think, because when you go into an office, you know, you're well dressed, you're professional, you're motivated, you're directed. Well, you can be anyway. But and there is something about having a direction and a purpose that being lashed often to that purpose. Makes you a more purposeful and enticing individual. Part of the reason why I wrote this book is because I like work. I like my own work, and I'm fascinated by people and their relationship to their work and how they define themselves by it. It seems to me that we are an even more work-centric culture than we were even 10 years ago. It manifests itself, I think, and I make quite extensive use of popular culture, and it does seem to me that we are going through an extraordinary stage of where previously work was invisible in popular culture. Now it has become quite central to a lot of cultural forms and representations. know, I've got a gratuitous picture of Don Draper here from Mad Men.
He's not smoking.
He's not smoking. The cigarettes are actually down there in the bottom right, left-hand corner. But I mean, if you look at, you know, the West Wing or The Wire or Boston Legal or Ally McBeal or The Thick of It or 30 Rock or indeed The Office, movies like The Company Men, Up in the Air, Horrible Bosses, Margin Call. I've really been enjoying going to these movies. Just simply to look at the offices. I'm not interested in the plots. I'm interested in, you know, what's on people's desks, what's on their computer screens, what's on their screensavers. It seems to me that we are. The other thing is that office work is beginning to invade our lives at all times. It's becoming all pervasive. Some people have argued that the office will eventually die because it's possible to work 24 hours a day, wherever you are. But in fact, that would be the office's ultimate triumph. The whole world would be an office. The office would travel with you wherever you went. You would never be able to get away from it. It's one of the reasons why I just thought this is a really interesting and useful stage to be writing about this subject. It's almost like I hate that expression, elephant in the room, but it's the elephant in the office. Yes, Mike.
The whole idea that you tie Shane Warne for the office. The question being, why of the present batch group collection of the present Australian cricket team, there's not one of them who can stride the stage? Therefore, would you say that the Australian cricketers and all manufactured sport in Australia, they have become outdoor office workers in colourful overpaid clothes?
Well, it's in the way the professional sportsmen do talk these days about a tough day at the office or a good day at the office. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, yeah. About a work ethic, yeah.
Or the playing group.
Yeah, or the bowling plan. Yeah. I did actually a couple of years ago describe listening to the Australian team as like listening to a bunch of mid-level bureaucrats who are very skilled at exculpating themselves from absolute responsibility. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Interesting, Shane Warne was actually an office worker. He was an office worker in Adelaide. Does anyone know that? He used to work at the SACA. When he was at the academy, he had a part-time job at the South Australian Cricket Association. He used to work for Barry Gibbs. And he was actually, apparently, a very good office worker. He used to do Barry Gibbs's filing for him, and he was very good at it. Barry Gibbs was famously chaotic in the way he managed his affairs, but in Barry Gibbs's book, My Cricket Journey, he talks about the fact that Warne was so good at filing that even now, 10 years after the events, he could actually go in and he could find evidences of the work that Warne did in the office. So that's kind of interesting, isn't it?
I had the great good fortune, or luck, whatever you want to call it, of being present on the great and legendary day where Mr. Warne totally confused Mr. Gatting. Still to this day, says, wait a minute, trick photography, first of all, where the hell. Now, Warne still lives on in our collective memory, like people who know nothing about cricket or have professed to have no knowledge of it, but are interested in cricket. How come that there are only two words associated with Michael Clarke, notwithstanding his statistics? Lara Beagle.
I think he's gotten beyond that. Well, Warne was a once in a lifetime. It's a little bit like complaining about the game after Bradman. You know, Ray Robinson said that cricket after Bradman was like a room with the light turned off, and I think there's a touch of that with Warne as well. Is there something we don't know about Lara? Has she scattered her favours freely? Yes, Michael.
Gideon.
Yeah.
To what extent does backstabbing feature in your the office?
Yeah, there's a section on office politics. Yeah, and I think it's interesting when you start beginning to run off the themes in this, how many common experiences there are. You know, I've got a section on, you know, office romance, and it conjures up a whole sort of repertoire of ideas. There's a I'll read you some of the titles in here. It's basically divided into two. The first part is historic, covers things like the feminization of the office, the rise and rise of the international style skyscraper. There's a section on the salaryman in Japan, air conditioning, personal computing, the invention of the cubicle, the ascendancy of email. The second half is about aspects of thematic aspects of office life, communication, emotion and instinct, goofing off, the pleasures of working, because there are, you know, there are distinct pleasures about it, doing it. The section about bosses, there's a chapter called The Glass Office, which is about discrimination in the workplace, and a section called The Dark Office, which is the office of oppression, hatred and violence, the office of bureaucracy and totalitarian regimes, for instance. In some senses, you know, probably the most important historical event of our lifetimes involves an office. What is it? 9/11, because of what the office and the sort of the technocratic commercial society represents to the forces of religious extremism. And, you know, there's a section about how they planned both that attack and the attack on the Alfred P. Murrah building in Oklahoma City. The ideas of bureaucracy as being a kind of, or the technocratic society and government bureaucracy as being a threat to freedom and a force of oppression. So believe me, Michael, I've covered the waterfront here. Although I must admit, Michael, it could have been twice as long by the time I finished with it. Yeah, Roger.
Gideon, we all love reading, and we all love your words and books, etc. You mentioned the book industry at the moment and all the modern Twitters and Facebooks and what's going on. If you could talk to English teachers at the moment, we're looking at 20 years down the track with books and what we all get out of it. What would your message be?
God.
Like Test cricket, real Test cricket.
Yeah. Well, the funny thing is, I mean, let's go to Test cricket. Test cricket, because there are parallels in the sense that, you know, Test cricket does require a certain sort of effort and a certain and patience, and it requires an appreciation of subtlety and an ability to exist with delayed gratification. All these are aspects of book reading as well. The funny thing is that I think there is a hunger for those things. I don't think that it's a common assumption among both sports marketers and publishers that people are growing up with shorter attention spans and a lower kind of complexity horizon. But I don't actually see that. It's interesting to me that kids these days are absolutely obsessed with the Tour de France. Now, it goes for 30 bloody days. And it's just a bunch of guys on cycles. That's all you see. And yet, they are fascinated by it. And I think there is something about the kind of the epic nature of that sporting contest that transcends short-term infatuations, that appeals to kind of more elemental aspects of human nature that even young people have. And I think that applies to reading as well. I think that there is a hunger out there for meaty subjects. I don't believe in talking down to my readers. I actually believe in kind of exciting them and enthusing them about the subjects that I take on. And I always think they're the most exciting subject I've ever discussed before, that I've ever explored before. And if you're feeling that way while you're writing it, then I can't help feeling that will communicate itself to the reader.
Yeah, firstly, Gideon, thanks for writing such readable cricket books. There are so many out there, and it's just good to have ones that are an absolute pleasure to read. Two quick questions. Who's your favourite cricket writer, other than Bernard, of course, and perhaps a couple of favourite cricket books? And how are the South Yarras going?
I'll answer the last question first, because we won an A-grade flag this year. We the first flag for 10 years. It was a classically grim, austere game of Australian club cricket. They were bowled out. We bowled them out for 96. They bowled us out for 75. We bowled them out for 41, and we knocked off the runs for three down. And it was 2 days of one run per over, with shouldering arms outside the off stump, getting rounds of applause. It was great, actually. It was fantastic. It was everything that a marketer would hate. Everything a marketer would find absolutely perplexing, because there was no cricketainment involved. And yet it was one of those games that you just couldn't wait to get around to reminiscing. We've got our presentation night coming up, and I'm sure the game has gotten even better. Has already improved somewhat in the retelling. I think a couple of cricket books that have influenced me very much. A book called The Willow Wand by Derek Burley, written in 1978. The subtitle is Some Cricket Myths Explored, and it's a book of interlinked essays about different aspects of sport in English life, and other countries too, amateurism, aggression, fast bowling, apartheid. I read it when I was, 12 years old, and it kind of, up until then, I'd just been a sort of a naive cricket fan, but this kind of revealed to me whole vistas of possibility in cricket writing. And it made me think that, you could actually go on writing about cricket and continue finding onion layers of meaning and interpretation. I've written, 15 cricket books or something like that, but they're not all the same book. They all seem very, very different books to me. I don't feel as though I've repeated myself in the course of my writing career, even though a lot of them seem to be about the same subject, and they have people holding bats on the front cover. I think probably another one that I really, really enjoyed and that I can continue to go back and read with pleasure is Alan Ross's book, Australia 55. Alan Ross was the Observer cricket correspondent, a highly literate, an articulate man, a fine poet, and a very perceptive observer of Australian life. And his book is kind of an account of both the cricket and the country at the time. It's a lovely little time capsule. And there are phrases in it that are a little bit like watching Shane Warne leg spinners on YouTube. You can read them 100 times and you still find them enjoyable. So they're two books that I would definitely take to a desert island with me.